Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
So we begin the service by ringing the mindfulness bell, which gives us permission to stop, to be still, and to breathe into this presence within and all around. Over my head there is the calligraphy of Thich Nhat Hanh, which says, "I have arrived, I am home." And so when we make it our intention to go home to a place within and all around that's always waiting for us, Eckhart Tolle wrote a beautiful little book called Stillness Speaks. And he said, stillness is the language of God. Everything else is a poor translation. And so when our intention is to return to that stillness, there is a discovery of a knower that abides in that stillness. I hear that sweet chant, "Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know." And so with the simplicity of ringing a bell and stopping the thought patterns that seem sometimes addictive, the simple act of stopping takes us into that still point. And if we can abide there for even a brief period of time, there is this sense of belonging, the sense of coming home, the sense of knowing who we are, and then feeling this deep, deep connection to not only the beloved, but to each other. In this month of March, the spring month of March, I'm exploring this salient idea of the art of being. The art of being. To be who we are. And the first week of this month, I explored the idea that we are God's seedling. And I hear Meister Eckhart say, if an acorn becomes an oak tree and a pear seed becomes a pear tree, well, then a God seed becomes a God. And so we come to this garden of the soul to plant seeds, seeds of truth, seeds of possibility, seeds of love. And then, like any good gardener, we allow that seed to germinate and to put down roots and ultimately grow into the manifestation of a life that we are living here, a life that continues to evolve. And so in the second week of this month, I explored the theme of resolve to evolve. And I hear Dr. Ernest Holmes, who said it is all about involution and evolution. When we evolve within ourselves, we assist others in evolving into what Barbara Marx Hubbard calls the homo universalis, the universal human. And so we smile to the inevitable consequence of setting an intention to evolve into our God seed, to live the life that we were meant to live, our destiny, if you will. And last week we explored another way of being human. Could we let our divinity support our humanity so that we become divinely human and humanly divine? Could we meet life not with the mind that wants to judge it and fix it and manipulate it, but with an open heart that wants to embrace it wherever it is and to see the good, the God in everything? And so in this final second to the end month week, I'm going to explore what gifts do we bring? And do we have the courage to share those gifts here on planet Earth? God so loved the world that she took up residence in every piece of creation so that she might shine her light and extend her love to all her children. And we are all the mother, and they are all our children. Playing with that metaphor, with an open heart and a playful mind, we open our eyes and we let ourselves be here now to experience our sense of belonging. You know, time is an illusion. All there really is the sacred moment. And yet, having said that, we're on a continuum here while we're in human form. And one of our beloveds, Reva Walker, is having her 90th birthday today. I mistakenly said on Wednesday, you're turning 80 today, and she says, I wish. So anyway, for those extra 10 years, we've decided that we're going to offer a birthday song for her. So if you would join with me. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Reva. Happy birthday to you. Isn't that wonderful to, you know, ever since I've been here, in fact, next week is Easter Sunday, and I came to Huntsville for my first Sunday service on Easter Sunday in 1989. So this is my 35th anniversary, and I remember so clearly, it was back at the old center. There was Reva Walker sitting right where she always sits. There was Judy Graff. I saw, there she is, sitting next to Hank, handsome Hank. And you were just a glimmer in her eye back then. She didn't, yeah, she was our piano player up here. I mean, God, we've been together for a very long time. Barbara was here with her beloved sister, Sandy. And thank God, Sandy gave me my first funeral. She was in a tragic car. I know, we've been around the block a time or two in the center. So you begin to see we have a history. And I'm so grateful for that history. I remember when Seamus was dragged in here by Tia. Boy, was that a ride. And divine love. Yes, Judy.
You married us 33 years ago today.
Oh, today. Wow. Wow. You know, I always say this on my wedding ceremonies, and I live by it now. It's Ernest Holmes says, divine love brings together and maintains together those who belong together. So when you know that divine love did all of this, and we're still together, isn't this an amazing thing to trust in this divine love? There is such a thing as divine love. And, you know, it's been guiding me my whole life. I have no clue. When they say, you know, change your thinking and change your life and you can manifest what you want, that doesn't work when you have no clue. Because I remember saying to the universe, I'll do it. I was supposed to be a school teacher in 1986 because my husband, it's almost 50 years now, he decided that we are going to go back and become school teachers so we can have the summers off to travel. So he got his master's in education, and then I went back to get my teaching certification. So for 2 years, I did all the paperwork. I got into the classroom. I was the first day of student teaching. And when I was there, I heard this voice in my head, because you'd ring the bells, the students would get up. You ring the bells, the students sit down. And I was going to have to work with the girls' basketball team, and I don't know how to play basketball. And I'm thinking, okay, I came home from that horrible first day of student teaching. Trey came home from school. How was it? How was it? I said, it's awful. I quit. You quit? You can't do that. What about the plans that we'd made? I said, the plans that you'd made. He says, well, whatever you do, you've created a void in your life, and whatever you do, make sure you fill that void with something that's positive. And whatever you do, don't become a minister. I had never thought of that. I'd been taking classes at that center in Atlanta, and wouldn't you know it, I didn't choose this. It kind of chose me. So I say I suffer from the Ruby Keeler syndrome. You know, that movie 42nd Street? She was the little chorus girl in the musical 42nd Street. Well, the star, she slipped and fell and broke her leg, and they went to Ruby Keeler and said, listen, you're going to have to go out there from the chorus line and go out there and be a star because we're all counting on you. So I remember one of the ministers couldn't speak in Atlanta, so they pulled me out of the practitioner corps, and I had to stand up and talk about spiritual mind treatment. Well, all of a sudden, I got a reputation. So they had me come and speak at this place in Huntsville that was a little study group. And I said, I don't want to go to Alabama, anywhere but Alabama. Well, then Alabama asked me to come. And I went to Kennedy and I said, I don't want to go to Alabama. You know that, but you know, it's very red state over there. And he said, you don't have to stay there, David. Just go there, become ordained in 3 years, and then you can go wherever you want to go. So I admit I came here with an ulterior motive. This would be a launching pad. But after 3 years, I didn't want to go. They offered me Hawaii. I didn't want to go. They offered me California. I didn't want to go. Because somehow I suffer from this thing called loyalty. Once I decide to grow a garden, I want to tend that garden. And it mattered to me that I stayed here. So I've been here for 35 years, and I don't regret a minute of it. So thank you for showing me how wrong I can be. So I've been gathering. You know, the teachers live within us. When I studied with Thich Nhat Hanh, and it was so synchronistic because it was in September of 2000. My mother died dramatically the first week of September. She had a heart attack. I remember going right from church on Sunday morning, flying there, disconnecting her on Tuesday morning. Then my teacher, Kennedy Schultz, dies of a brain tumor a week later in Atlanta. And then a week after that, I find myself in Ascutney, Vermont, on a 10-day silent retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, the one that coined this calligraphy over my head. And this was in the tent. There were like 900 people there. There was this over him. And he sat there in a little chair like this. And he did this with his hands. And I'm sitting in the front row, kind of like where you are, Skip. And he says, all of life is a transmission. He said, there is a transmitter. There is a receiver. And there is that which is transmitted. He said, your parents do nothing less than transmit themselves to you. They live in you. Your teachers do nothing less than transmit themselves to you. They live in you. And then I thought, holy shit, my tears are coming down my face. And I thought, I walked out of that tent and I saw my mother in every flower. I saw Kennedy speaking to me from every tree. And I thought, I'm either going crazy or there's a piece of the puzzle that I haven't figured out yet. Well, trust me, they do live in us. And that's the grace of it all. To arrive at this place of age 75, my beloved twin sister passed away Christmas a year ago. And, you know, we were estranged for a long period of time. She was on the West Coast, I'm on the East Coast. But as soon as she left her body, all of a sudden I feel her with me all the time. And I've gone to some friends and asked if I'm crazy. And they say, no, you're not crazy. Just get used to it. Spirit is not bound by form. And then I realized that not just the ones that I've known, but the teachers that I've had, like Emerson, lives in me. Emerson's process was my process. When I found him, he totally confused me. I couldn't understand this mental science. And then there was this mystic like Emerson. And Emerson would say, there's a stream whose source is hidden. And from whence it comes, I know not. But when it comes in its fullness. And I am a pensioner. I draw from that something. Well, all of a sudden, there is this stream, this awareness, this Christ consciousness, if you, it doesn't matter what you call it. And when it starts to reveal itself to you, could you open to its guidance through lowly listening? And then you realize this practice never ends. By the way, beloved Seamus is going to, on his birthday, April 13th, same as Pam Hurdy's birthday, he's going to be doing a beautiful meditation class on connecting to the source. It's here at the center on Saturday. And so there's a sign-up sheet out there. I've also agreed to restore the satsang on Wednesday nights, starting on April 3rd. From 6 to 7:30. It'll be similar to the revealing service we did today with the satsang. Satsang means sitting in truth. And I realize there's so many of you that want a night class. And even though I'm challenged driving at night, Jody Rutenberg and I will drive together. And then I won't have to do that thing with the lights and the eyes and all that sort of stuff. And I will manage and we can get together and connect at that level of the heart. So it's important that we We're here to walk each other home, as Rumi says, always realizing that we're already there and that everything is here for us. One of my great gurus, teachers who lives inside me, is John O'Donohue, who wrote the Anamkara. Every time I open that book, I feel like I'm falling in love with God. And this is one of his last books. It's a book called Beauty, Rediscovering the Two Sources of Compassion, Serenity, and Hope. And being that he was a monk at one time, he has a spiritual practice of retreating into solitude, into silence. And in that silence and solitude, you find your true nature. And the gift we're here to give is our true nature, is our authentic self. Gary Zukav wrote a book called The Seat of the Soul, and it was all about living in this authentic place. So John O'Donohue has a very strange take on the gifts. He says the gifts of life that we're here to offer the world are always a surprise. A surprise? Yeah. He says all beauty is a gift. And then he quotes Shakespeare, "The cause of this fair gift in me is wanting. The cause of this fair gift in me is wanting." There's something authentic in here that wants to be revealed, to express. That's why Seamus is doing the workshop. That authentic self wants to come out and dance in the world. Next Sunday, I'm speaking about express thyself. Well, it's the self within the self that longs, as Shakespeare says, to express. You know, I'm trapped in Hamlet. When I was in ninth grade, I went to the state competitions doing Hamlet's soliloquy. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and in opposing, end them, to die, to sleep no more. So he goes on to say, sometimes I need a little bit of help from my friend here. He says, many of the most luminous gifts of our lives arrive as complete surprises. A gift is the most beautiful of intrusions. It arrives undeserved and unexpected. It comes ashore into our hearts, carefully formed to fit exactly the shape of a hunger that we might not even know that we had. So there's this greater intelligence that knows when there's some ache within our soul that wants to express. When I found Rumi, it set me on fire. I'm surprised half the church kind of left when I was up here melting every Sunday because I'd fallen into the... Judy was here. Her mother walked right out. She wanted a metal scientist. She didn't want someone dissolving into the oneness. The gift comes with no price tag, no demand that puts us under an obligation. Every gift has an inner lamp that casts a new brightness over an undiscovered field within our heart. So could we know that these gifts are opening our heart and open to be surprised? If you say you want to fall in love with God and then God takes you to your knees, well, that's on purpose. That was the gift. The gift comes with no price tag, no demand, but puts us under an obligation. Every gift has an inner lamp that casts a new brightness over an undiscovered field of the heart. And in this light, we discover and bring to birth something that is new within us. Eyes of our mind can never unveil the true source of this gift. The gift keeps its reason secret. Some unexpected path might open up in the interim world, and the gift was already on its way toward you. We're being called by something greater. Could we open to that? He said, the gift, God brought you all here. It's not an accident. And then the fact that you came back, Amy, once I was in a musical in college, once in love with Amy. Have you heard that song? Always in love with Amy. Ply her with flowers, poetry, and I've got all these musicals in my head. Sometimes it's difficult to know when you're getting a gift. Its arrival is often a shock. At the beginning, it might seem to be the furthest thing from a gift that you could ever imagine. I mean, imagine when I was going to New York City, graduated from college, I'm 21 years old, with my partner, all 4 years in college, his name was Peter. We were ready to get on the plane, JFK Airport, we had our year rail pass for 3 months, and as I'm getting ready to board, he says, oh, by the way, David, I'm not going to Europe with you. I'm going back to Colorado to be with my new boyfriend, Trey, my current husband. And I was shocked. And so he gets on the plane to go back to Denver, and I go over to Europe not knowing who I was. It was the best gift anybody could have ever given me. I didn't know who I was. I had tears in my eyes all the way over. I had to find myself. It's baptism by fire. And you know what? When I came back from that 3-month trip and he's at the airport, he's dumped Trey by that stage and he wants to be back with me. I said, you know what? I outgrew you. And then I heard Victor Hugo, be like the bird who pausing for a while on boughs too slight, feels them give way beneath her, yet sings knowing she hath wings. Well, I found my wings in Corfu, Greece, and I decided I'm not going back. But then, you know, that was the gift. Who would have thought? Had to go all the way to Europe to find that one. We forget that the darkness of the unknown within us is also the fecund soil, urgent with seeds of new possibilities. Ooh. The beauty of the gift, then, is the secret way it awakens us to growth. Are you ready to grow, even if it might be uncomfortable? Sometimes the universe asks us to let go of something in order to step into something new. I'm just saying, without altering our anxiety or forcing confrontation, our inner gift has placed us on a path of change almost before we even realize it. A path of change. Just a little bit more, because John O'Donohue is so rich. He says, like a parent to the soul, our gift carries us carefully over torn ground until our feet stand free in a serene place where we can recognize that we have been blessed by the tumultuous life that somehow we seem to be living. We're not being punished. Lastly, every life is blessed with a different sequence of gifts. Often the gift arrives secretly, and you only find it later. Or perhaps you are looking back over time as you would look through an old drawer and you come upon something that you had put away ages ago. You rediscover an old gift and you enter again into the wonder. This is one of the loveliest capacities of our memory. Don't you love the fact that you get to a certain age and when you reflect back on the past, you're remembering the positive moments, remembering the love? I remember, as dysfunctional as my parents were, I remember how loving they were to us kids. They were the God figures, as Anastasia pointed out. And when they were young, they were playful. Yeah, they had addictive problems, but they knew how to play with their little kids. And we were little kids once. So I have these fond memories of my mom and dad. This is one of the lovely capacities of our memory, the reawakening of these new blessings through a rediscovery of the old gifts in forgotten corners. It is the prospect that animates faith. I was working in New York City at a music publishing company, and I was the copyright manager, so I had to renew the copyrights on all the old music that came in from the past. And I remember I was struggling with my personal life. I'm 21. I decided relationships are not for me. I didn't believe that love existed. I was dealing with my homosexual nature. My father was really estranged. And all of a sudden, I found a piece of sheet music. And I think one of the gifts that I have is I'm able to catch the hint. And this piece of sheet music changed my life. And the sheet music, the title of the song was called You Can't Get Lovin' Where There Ain't Any Love. And I was looking for love, like from my father. And I realized the song healed me. The song says, you can't get lovin' where there ain't any love, just like you can't get honey where there ain't any bees. And if someone doesn't have the capacity to offer you that love, well, then if you keep going up and expecting love and you don't receive love, well, that has nothing to do with you. They can't give what they don't have to give. And so standing at a filing cabinet with tears coming down my eyes at 21 years of age, I'm finally realizing I was expecting love from a source that couldn't give that love. In a holy instant, I was set free of this neurotic pattern to get something out there. So these little secrets sometimes wake you up, and then you think, okay. I had another shocking moment when I went to see the Sufi teacher, Llewellyn Van Lee. And I'm a religious science minister at this time, you know, trying to create a better illusion for myself. And I remember him saying, it's not about you. It's never been about you. It's about the beloved. It's about God. And then I went, holy cow. I've been making this all about me, manifesting a better illusion in this world when it's never been about me. So in that holy instant, the gift of awareness, and then Llewellyn said, the most important things on this spiritual journey are your attention. What are you putting your attention on? Are you putting your attention on the good, the God, the possibilities that are wanting to emerge? Or are you putting your attention on the past and the dysfunction? And then, you know, I remember my mother came to visit me in Atlanta, and you'll appreciate this, Anastasia. As soon as she got there, every one of my buttons was being pushed. I was just awful. Trey said, what happened to you, David? I said, my mother is pushing all my buttons. And then he said, that's because she installed them. And then I had a little laugh. And then I went to the gym and I sat in the sauna for 2 hours. And then I realized that's her job. She knows how to push my buttons, and she would do it with the word should. Scott, you should do this. Scott, you should do that. You should do this. You should do. And I said, Mother, you've been shooting on me my whole life. I have to do things my way. And so, you know, you begin to see the gifts in the strangest places. The very thing that you thought wasn't becomes the thing that is. I taught this wonderful book by Wayne Mueller a few years ago. It's called How Then Shall We Live, Knowing That We Will Die? And he bases the idea of giving our gifts on four simple questions. And then you live in the question. The first question is, who am I? If I still think it's about me, David Leonard, well, then I'm really at a low level. But if I could say, who am I? I am divine love offering her expression here on planet Earth. The second question is, what do I love? You know, the wonderful phrase, do what you love and the money will follow. Ernest Holmes says, let love lead the way and let law make the way possible. So could we ask our question, what do we love? Because that's bringing the highest vibration of you into this world. We're all here as ambassadors of love, and love is God's expression in the world. The third question that Wayne Mueller did was, how then shall I live knowing that I will die someday? So could life then become a sacred journey where we're bringing our soul to the experience? And, you know, Skip is a retired minister. Now his ministry is launched in all these new directions because you're never done. Seamus is going to retire in October, I believe it is. And I remember someone says, you don't retire, you rewire, because you're still here. So could we let our rewiring be one that's intentional from the soul where we can serve at the highest level? And the fourth question he asks is, what is my gift to the family of this earth? What is my gift to the family of this earth? And in non-dual teachings, and we're a non-dual teaching, we're all part of the one family. There's no hierarchy. Humans aren't superior to the four-leggeds or the two-leggeds or the winged ones or the little fish in the pond. Then you start having a relationship that has equanimity. You know, the trees, suddenly the raindrops that fall have a meaning. So at the end of this book, he gives a little flair about what the gifts are for him. I like the varying ways they approach it. So for John O'Donohue, it's a shock and a surprise, and it helps you grow. This is a totally different one. As we explore the nature of our gift, our gifts, our goal is to move toward a certain generosity of giving. And then he talks about, it's all about receiving and giving. You can't give unless you can both receive and give. So could we let our receiving be opening to the creative forces of the universe, Tia, because you're not the doer, and then it can paint your paintings through you and write your poetry through you, and it can dance through you, and it's not you. You don't have to take credit for it. And then there's a generosity in your giving because you're not the giver. I've discovered, you know, these plants around the center in my house is filled with plants, and people are talking about the new blossoms of spring. I've spent my whole life tending a garden. And you know what happens with the garden? It has a life of its own. It gets huge and dramatic and beautiful. And then if you have a conservative, fearful little husband like I do, he wants me to get rid of all the plants in the yard and put mulch down. And I'm saying, you know, I can't do that any more than I could pull out all the wildflowers in the garden because they proliferate, they spread. I have ferns coming up everywhere, rare. Oy vey. So let your giving be generous giving, cheerful giving. Let it flow gently and easily from you. Kingly giving that flows surely from who you really are. And as we answer this simple question, who are we and what do we love? The gift we bring will be easy because our gifts naturally emerge from who we are. The greatest gift, he says, you give is your true self to the world, to give who you are. And then I hear Dr. Bernie Siegel, who was given an honorary doctorate in Atlanta for his book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles. And Bernie Siegel got up in front of this large audience and he said, I live by one simple principle, be who you is and not who you ain't. Because if you ain't who you is, well, then you is who you ain't. And if you is who you ain't, well, you ain't who you is. Be your true self. The gift we bring will be easy because our gift is natural. It emerges from who we are. And this offering we bring is ourselves, Tia, just as we are. Don't change a hair for me. Not if you care for me. Yes, you are strange. But you're an otter in a human body. And we got to know that that's, otters are playful. They're the ones that will lie next to each other on their back and they feed each other. And she's an otter. I'm a little bit of a penguin. Our gift is our true nature, he says. There can be no other gift than this. So he goes on to say in his little chapter, what is my gift to the family of this earth? Whatever gift we bring necessarily arises from who we authentically are. So we're here to be our authentic self, Skip. Just your authentic, crazy, wonderful self. The four meditations that he offers, who are you, what we love, how we live, and name our gifts, they all flow into one another. So then we can say what we love teaches us how to live. What we love teaches us how to give. I'm so envious of these grandparents in the audience. There was a lady, she was walking her dog this morning when I was pushing the pug in his stroller, and she has this beautiful little dog named Rusty, and Rusty came running over to me, and I said, how have you been? She said, I've been with my three grandchildren. I think I'm going to die. And I think she lives a block away from you, Pam. And I thought, I need to get Pam with this grandmother who's struggling with her grandchildren, because obviously, I was going to say, have you planned your Easter egg hunt? I couldn't remember. I bet you planned it, haven't you, Pam? Oh, yes. Going to dye those eggs. Who we are and what we love, how we live and naming our gifts, they all flow into one another. So what we love teaches us how to live, and what we give helps us learn about who we are. And in this way, perhaps we may learn to drink from the immeasurable grace of our single human life. In this way, may we live from the grace of this single human life that we've been given. Isn't that a blessing, Robert, that you've been given this life? And now what are you going to do with it? We're at this certain threshold, so many of us, where we can consciously choose to live the life that we want to live. The world isn't telling us that you have to conform to a certain model. And could we then put our attention on the qualities that we want to live? Like one of the qualities that I like to live is from compassion. I like to live from kindness. I think it's Wayne Mueller in this book. He says, one of the greatest gifts that you can give the world is to do no harm. Isn't that a profound one? I was driving to the center this morning, and all of a sudden, a neurotic squirrel with his nut in his mouth came running right in front of my car. I stopped the car because he stopped right in front of me. I said, you got to go one way or the other, Kelly, because I'm not going to run over you. I'm not going to give you that pleasure. And he looked at me, and then he decided this way, that way, and he finally went to the curb, looked back at me. I said, thank you, and I took off and went. Now, the car is behind me. I'm sure it thought differently. But, you know, to make a vow to do no harm, to bring the best when you see something struggling in this world. So lastly, I pulled out my Jack Kornfield, this Buddhist teacher of mine. I studied with him in Northern California, and he has this lovely little book called No Time Like the Present, and his classic book was called The Path of the Heart. And he talks about your gift is your authentic self, to bring your authentic self. Now, what would your authentic, not a carbon copy of someone else's version of you, but who you really are. And at the end of the book, he gives us a take on what this authentic self might look like in the world. See if this feels good for you. The whole purpose of our human incarnation, says Maladoma Somme, an African shaman, and I study with him in New York City. You know, so many of the indigenous people have the right idea because they're connected to Pachamama and Pachipapa. They're connected to this life outside of us. And so Maladoma Somme said, the purpose of this human incarnation is to bring your gifts into the world. He says, nothing else creates so much fulfillment and meaning in our lives as expressing the unique capacities that we each possess and then offering those gifts generously to the world. So could we do that self-inquiry and say, what gifts do I bring? Maybe I bring a sense of humor. I bring the ability to goof on things. I bring the ability to be playful. There's an inner child in me that's very, very healthy. I bring a great sense of creativity and wonder. I love, we have a poster in the men's room. It's Albert Einstein says, the imagination is more important than the intellect. I don't know, want to know what man thinks. I want to know what God thinks. So could we, through lowly listening and through our creative imagination and inviting that child of wonder and awe to reveal her secrets because she's still in there. I love playing with Pam because there's a little girl in Pam and a little girl and a little boy in David that they have fun together because they don't take themselves too seriously. Bring these gifts into the world. Nothing else creates so much fulfillment and meaning in a life as expressing the unique capacities and offering those gifts. So, Jack Kornfield says, pay attention to what you love more than anything. What lights you up? And what do you care about? In the Bhagavad Gita, he goes on to say, helping others through selfless service is called the direct path to God. Helping others through selfless service is called the direct path to God. It's so funny. Adam, you know, brings in these flowers for all of us to share because one of his jobs is to, when they're going to throw the flowers out, he takes them and he said it was very difficult for him because they all have consciousness. So he brings them to the center and so many of us bring them home. And one Sunday he had so many bouquets. I had four dozen roses, red ones, yellow ones, pink ones, white ones. Well, the neighbor next door had just had a colonoscopy or a colon operation and she'd just gotten back from the hospital. So I carried over a dozen roses to her. Well, she had a living room filled with the ladies in the neighborhood. The neighbor across the street said, "Where's my roses?" Well, it turns out she had a mastectomy this week. So I brought her over the roses. Then the lady across the street, her husband died in a boating accident. So I bring her the third dozen roses. Well, then I have the fourth dozen roses. And I think, do I dare keep these roses? And then I saw the lady across the street, and she was going to feed the fish when I go out of town. And I said, "You know, I don't pay you to feed the fish. There's only two." I says, "Why don't you take these roses?" "Oh, you thought I'd given her $1 million. So here, these four reject roses were given to four women who at a moment who needed some love, received this love. It's like there are no accidents. Yeah, selfless service. In the Bhagavad Gita, helping others through selfless service is called the direct path to God. So as you serve, gradually you will discover that helping others is like caring for your own child, your own body. Pam and I have some grow boxes over at Luders Park, and I was over there watering the peas and the collards. And this lady came up to me with her three grandchildren. She says, "Do you know where I could get one of these boxes to grow some plants in?" And I happen to have three now because two people abandoned them, and I could have given her one of my boxes. But I said, "Help yourself. There's plenty of collards, there's plenty of peas, and I think there's an abandoned one. Trey thought your other box was an abandoned one." I said, no, that's not abandoned. She just hasn't been planted yet. And so I'm spending this whole morning sharing my vegetables from the garden, knowing that we're all in this together, and they're not my boxes. In fact, one of them belongs to Jody Rutenberg, and the other belongs to Jane Stearns. Now, Jane Stearns isn't on the planet, but I still grow it for her, and Jody's still on the planet, so you could say that I'm cheating. So what gifts do you bring? Ask yourself that. What gifts do you bring? As I was sitting down with that question this week, I realized one of the gifts that I think I have a capacity to do is to catch the hint when the universe is giving us hints. Like when you think you're in control, you're really kind of screwed up. Thank you, Amy. And so I went back to, I was in San Francisco, 1975. Trey and I just made a commitment to be together. And I had all these degrees. I didn't have anywhere to go. And all of a sudden, I went to see A Chorus Line. And I'm sitting in the balcony, and I'm hearing Donna McKechnie, way a little actress on the stage. She sings, "God, I'm a dancer, and a dancer dances. Give me somebody to dance for. Give me some place to fit in. All I ever needed was the music and the mirrors and the chance to dance for you." Well, in that holy instant, at 25, I decided to go back and get my master's degree in dance. Well, I'm no Baryshnikov. So I'm 25, I'm lying on the dance floor, and the choreographer says, "All movement is discovered, it's not invented." Well, in that holy instant, a light bulb went off. Everything has to be discovered. Your truth has to be discovered. So then my master's thesis in dance was all about the anatomy of inspiration. Where does it come from? And there's Emerson. There is a stream whose source is hidden. And I start exploring Mozart and William Butler Yeats. They all access this intelligence, this creative something. And that launched me into this exploration of spirituality. So none of us knows where we're going to catch these hints, where they're going to come from us. And then I hear Rumi inside me. Rumi says, "There is a stream." No, he says, "Out beyond the ideas of right thinking and wrong thinking," he says, "there is a field." This is that field of pure awareness. And when the soul lies down in that field, words are not necessary. Oftentimes they get in the way. Even the idea, each other, does not exist. And then he says, "I will meet you there." So what if we come here to meet in that field of divine love, where words are not necessary? And I'm sure with Seamus' beautiful workshop on meditation, he's going to take us into a deep place of connection. He always does with me. And I will meet you there. So we have this invitation to meet in a field of divine love. But you know, an invitation is one thing. You have to say yes to the invitation. So could we then, when I was studying with Thich Nhat Hanh, he's kind of in me now, you spent the whole 10 days in silence. The only time you would speak when you were given these little groups and you were given an opportunity to process what was arising. And you would have to raise your hand, and then you would express. And when you were done, you'd say, I am done, and you'd bow to the circle. When you would eat your food, you would go into the dining room. You would bow to the food before you would take it, so everything was done mindfully. You would sit at a table with total strangers. You would bow to the place you were sitting. You'd bow to the people they were eating with. And 10 days in total silence took you into a place where you didn't want to talk anymore. You didn't want to hear noise extraneously outside yourself, like putting on the radio. There was something about the silence had claimed each one of us, and we were walking. And then Thich Nhat Hanh, because he would always participate, he was a very active guru. He was always with you. So in the morning, he would do walking meditations. So there's this little monk in his little brown clothes, and he's standing there in silence, and we'd all line up behind him. And then in a silent sort of way, he would say, the miracle is not to walk on water, as they say Jesus did. The miracle is not to walk on fire, which seems to be the craze today. He says, the miracle is to walk on earth where every step is a sacred blessing. And so as we followed him, and he's taking one little mindful step after the other, just like little lemmings, we're following him down the path of life. And then I noticed there'd been rain in Vermont, and the little worms were crossing the pathway. And I was sidestepping the worms, thinking, I hope they're sidestepping the worms. But of course they are, because they're mindfully walking down the path over the worms, as am I. So my mind wanted to get in there as a codependent. Don't step on the worms. But I kept my mouth shut, which I'm not normally do I, Tia? And we all. But, you know, you have these moments where you catch the hint that stillness is such a beautiful place to hang out in. I feel like I've kind of found myself at this stage of life where I love solitude. You know, I don't like to have the TV on. I just like to sit in solitude. Does that mean I'm antisocial? I don't think I'm antisocial, but there's something about the silence that feels like such a refuge. Even with my sweet husband, he's always wanting to watch sports. You know, the basketball thing? It's on steroids in our house. He does the March Madness game with all the family members. Everybody's got a score. Every day it goes out. I am the lowest on the whole March Madness out of 30 people. And I guess it's because I didn't really care when I filled out the brackets. And I put my home state of South Dakota. South Dakota State was in there, so I put them going all the way. They lost the first game. Oh, well. So, but, you know, there's a gift in seeing yourself with soft eyes, with compassion, that at this stage of my life, I don't have that ambition. I don't have that drive to acquire things anymore. If anything, I want less is more. And to live a simple life, and to just garden simple things, to eat simply. 'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to fall down. That's the Quaker song. So could we find the gift of simplicity in our lives?
Thank you for listening to our podcast. More information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.